And they still live?
Yes, but they also insulted Ghana, your country.
It is nothing.
Nothing?
This is not their place. In time, they will pass. Ghana was here when they came. When they go, Ghana will be here. They are like mice on an elephant's back.
A poor, uneducated servant in Ghana was so secure, he could ignore establishment white rudeness. No black American I had ever known knew that security.
Don't let them trouble your heart. Your people, they belong, not them.
He turned and shuffled back to the lounge.
Are you sick, Comfort?
She could barely string my hair, as there was no strength in her hands.
No, sister, I am not sick, just weary.
I hadn't seen Comfort for several months, by which time her laughter had diminished along with about 30 pounds of sensuous curves.
Sister, you have wearied yourself into bad health.
I am getting weaker each day. It's the woman, she is doing it.
What woman? Doing what?
His old wife is using some bad medicine on me. First she gave permission for us to be friendly, then she saw how he loves me, and she said no and cursed me.
Comfort had fallen in love with an older, married man.
Then that's when she promised that I would lose.
Lose him?
Lose everything. My looks, my wit, my mind. Oh, sister, she has power medicine. I might even lose my life.
Did she give you something to drink?
I was thinking arsenic.
No, I eat at home. I have a cousin and a servant from my village who will look after me.
Well, maybe if you talked to the woman herself. Oh, don't shudder like that. I'm sorry.
The woman came to my house. Once I was fat and fine as cocoa butter, and the man was loving me. And when she came to my house, I asked her what she wanted. Not sweetly, God forgive me. I was crazy. I didn't offer her a drink.
She was shaking her head, not believing her rudeness to the old woman.
I wouldn't even sit down. She's old, sister, and I still stood looking down on her. She asked me, "Do you know what love costs?" And I said, "I am not a market woman, so I do not think of everything in money terms." I raised my voice. I said, "I wasn't so old and ugly I had to buy love." I sucked my teeth at that woman. She said, "You will lose. You will lose all." And then she walked out of my house, and see me now. The man will not come, and my flesh is falling away.
Have you seen a doctor, Comfort?
I've been to many African doctors. Nobody can remove the curse. There's one last hope for me. I have heard there is a woman in Sierra Leone. She is very good. I must go and stay 2 weeks cleansing myself. I must pay her in pure gold.
Well, I don't have gold, but let me lend you some money.
Sister, thank you, but my uncle is a goldsmith, and I have plenty of trinkets. When I come back, we will sit out in your compound, and you will make me laugh, and I will have strength while I have my hands on your head. And I want you to make me laugh. Oh, sister, I cannot say how much I want to laugh.
Oh, Comfort. I hope it all goes well.
I will come back in 2 months fine, fat and laughing.
2 weeks later, a friend of Comfort's came to my door. Comfort had not even been a week in Sierra Leone when she died.
I'm sorry to bring this news. She so loved to laugh with you.
Thank you for letting me know.
I watched the moon grow red as fire over the hills. The breeze of the night swept around my dress with unseemly intimacy, then disappeared into the utter blackness. Comfort had passed into the life of our ancestors. And her life and death had proved the reality of the illusion of Africa. The sunlit dance floor seethes with wiggling bodies. I had come out for Thanksgiving. As I looked around, I saw a beautiful man in a white lace grand boubou, a loose tunic worn over narrow trousers.
Who is that?
He sat so high above the surface of the table, he had to be over 6.5 feet tall. He looked like romantic drawings of ancient African kings on caparisoned horses. He bent his great bulk to speak privately with one of the men. Then he and his party left. Except for the man, who came directly over to me and asked,
"May I take a little of your time?"
"You may."
He sat nicely on the edge of a chair.
"May I ask your name and if you are married?"
My answers were as direct as his questions.
"Is it possible that you noticed a large man who was sat at that table?"
"I noticed him."
"He is Shekali, and he has asked me if you will dine with him tonight."
"But I have no idea who he is. Where does he live? What does he do?"
"Miss Angelou, he is from Mali. He imports thoroughbred horses and was formerly the largest importer of beef to Ghana. He has his own place, and I am certain he would take you to a very fine restaurant."
"But is he not married?"
There had been 3 very attentive women in his company.
"All personal questions must be directed to himself. If you agree to dine, I will need your address. He will come for you at 9 o'clock.
Back at the house, I showered, changed, and sat waiting.
"Maybe I accepted too quickly. What if he's a kidnapper and sells me to an Arab trader?"
There was still an active slave market. I imagined the American government sending troops in to rescue me. And then... it was too late. He was here. Do or die.
"Come in!"
My knees immediately weakened at the knock on my door.
"I'm coming!"
I reined in wild horses and smiled at him with calm dignity.
"Miss Angelou."
"Hello. Well, please come in."
Sheikh Khali filled up the hole outdoors. He wore yards of blue silk embroidered in gold, a small blue lace cap draped jauntily over his brow.
"Please take a seat. My friends will be home shortly."
"Your friends want to eat with us at the restaurant?"
"Oh, I need to let my friends know where I am and who I'm with."
"You can write them a note. I am taking you to L'Auberge restaurant in my Avion d'Argent."
In the restaurant, he waved away the menu.
"We will have the coquille Saint-Jacques, trout, and beefsteak. I suppose you drink wine."
"Thank you, but I don't eat fish or seafood. I'd like steak and vegetables and no wine."
"Mademoiselle will have steak, vegetables and wine, good wine, and I will have the same, but a carafe of water for me. Mademoiselle Angelou, may I call you Maya? I have visited France often, but you know I had never been to America. I've been told that after slavery, white Americans gave their money to the blacks, and now the blacks are rich. Is this true?"
"What? No, no."
"Why are you not married?"
"I..."
"Are all the men in Ghana blind? I think they are."
He touched my hand very gently.
"Don't you want children? You must not wait long. For a woman can live without a husband, but everyone must have at least one child."
"Well, I have a son. Here, at university."
"University? But how old are you?"
"My mother says a woman who will tell her own age will tell anything."
"I like a funny woman. Pretty women are seldom funny. I like you."
And I liked him. He was certainly the most sublimely handsome man I had ever seen.
"Tell me about yourself. Everything but your age."
He was the first son of a 4th wife. His father sired 32 children. At 10 years old, he began herding cattle through rainforests, across the savannas, and over the desert.
"By 13, after my initiation into manhood, I became the leader of the drive. I alone supported my mother and her family."
I compliment you. You've had a hard youth, but now you have become a rich man.
I was a man at 13. I am still a man. Nothing has changed.
That balance of maleness and manliness intrigued me. After dinner...
This hotel has the best dance band in Accra. Dance with me, Maya.
The man could move. He spun around and yards of blue silk billowed. Lights glinted off the golden threads.
You move like a night wind. A soft night wind. I like you.
I like you too.
At the end of the evening...
I can take you home. Or we could go to my apartment in this hotel.
Happily, I chose the apartment. The attraction was intense and mutual. Sheikh Ali was exotic, generous, and physically satisfying. And although we were very different, we were to go on seeing one another. On the domestic front, Vicky and I had pooled our funds to pay for a houseboy to clean the bungalow and help with the meals.
Auntie?
Yes, Uncle.
There's a boy, Kojo, who would like to speak to you.
Oh, what does he want?
Oh, Auntie, should I know?
Otu didn't look at me directly, and I knew the conversation promised to be as formal as a Japanese tea ceremony.
Well, Otu, if you do not know, I shall not know. Then I cannot speak to the boy.
Auntie, if I am to say that which I do not know, I will serve neither you, the boy, nor myself.
Uncle?
Auntie?
This boy, Kojo, who wants to see me, is he a nice boy?
Yes, Auntie. His family is good. His father and uncle are from my village.
And how can I help him?
This boy would like to work for you, Auntie.
Oh, too, there is no job here. Please tell him.
Auntie, he has not asked me for a job. He has asked to speak to you.
Well, all right. Tell him to come around. I will speak to him.
He's just there, Auntie. Kojo! Kojo, brah!
A boy of about 13 stepped into the room.
Evening, Auntie.
Kojo, I am sorry, but...
I couldn't help but notice Kojo's resemblance to my beloved brother, Bailey.
I have no job for you.
Auntie, I can do anything. I can shop and save you money at Makola Market, and even from the woman who sell in Bokum Square. I hear Gat and Hausa. I can clean, and I'm learning to tailor.
But I shop, and I have a dressmaker.
I can be your small boy, Auntie. I can bring you bail and wash your car, and if Wofa or two teach me, I can laundry. Auntie, I don't want money, no salary, just dash tips.
Well, Otu, can you use a small boy?
Auntie, all children are serviceable. Everyone can use a small boy.
When he smiled, he had Bailey's straight, white teeth.
Kojo, I will take you.
Thank you, Auntie. Thank you, Wofa or two.
Within weeks, he seemed a part of the household.
Oh, too, I'm going to make a stew this evening.
Yes, Auntie.
What the... Kojo, what are you doing?
I'm tidying the vegetable trays, Auntie.
Kojo, they don't need tidying. Come on out. You are in the way.
Sorry, Otu. Sorry, Auntie.
At other times...
Auntie, is Kojo on a job for you? I can't find him.
No, I haven't seen him for a while. There he is.
Sat in my car, playing.
Oh, you may as well leave him. He looks like he's having fun.
You are too soft with him, Auntie.
And then sometimes...
See, Auntie, how your candlesticks shine? I polish well, yes?
Very well, Kojo. Thank you.
May I go outside and play for a while?
Of course.
Thank you, Auntie.
Auntie, He's polishing over my polishing. I polished this morning.
Did you? Oh, he was so proud.
Kojo managed to do everything with such charm, he'd melt my heart each time. One morning...
What's this?
Auntie, it's for you. It came today from the Mali man.
But I have a refrigerator.
I know, but you could have too.
No, certainly not.
His little shoulders fell, and he walked away. That evening... Sheikh Ali paid me a visit.
I am disappointed that you refused the refrigerator, but let me pay your rent and give you money for your car.
You must understand. I am a working woman and I pay for myself. It's the only way for me.
I understand. But I will marry you and I will take you to Mali. You can learn my language and you can teach my children French and English.
You have children?
I have 8 children from 2 women, but only 1 wife. You will like her. She is a good woman, tall like you.
He sat on the bed, looking like a black Buddha in his white undershirt.
You will be my second wife. I will build you a beautiful house and you will be happy.
But if you have 1 wife who is good, why do you want to marry me? And you already have children, so what do you want with me?
If I want more children, I will take a younger girl. But you are kind and educated. My family will accept you.
Thank you, but it's not the life I want.
Women always say no. I will find out what you want, and then I will ask again.
He did ask again many times and got the same answer.
Auntie, Kojo wants to speak to you.
Oh, he speaks to me all the time.
He thought he would speak to you after dinner.
I suppose I should have known something important was coming.
Auntie, you see I'm a small boy?
Yes, everyone could see that.
And I need to go to school?
Of course. Summer was ending. He would have to return to his village.
Yes, Kojo, you need an education. When will you be leaving?
The school I want is here, in Accra, Auntie. Just near this place.
Then it all seemed to fit into place. He wanted me to send him to school and to pay his fees. I had been set up.
No, Auntie. I have my school fees and the school has accepted me. Only I want to continue to come here.
Oh, well, if you are able to do both, you are welcome.
A few weeks later, I met with his headmaster. Kojo had brought good grades from his village school, but he would need a great deal of help at home with the required subjects he had not studied. So, 3 nights a week.
Again, Kojo, you need to be able to conjugate those verbs perfectly for your test tomorrow.
Auntie, look.
Well done.
His youthfulness and honesty and likeness to Bailey were totally enchanting.
Auntie.
What is it now, Kojo? Clothes, shoes, a new school?
Auntie, there are some people to see you.
Where? What do they want?
In the backyard, Auntie.
The yard was filled with people dressed in rich cloth and gold.
Good afternoon, Auntie. We would speak to you.
Oh, I see. Well, please, come inside.
The people filed into the living room, each person shaking my hand. I had no idea what the occasion was, but the formality of my visitors was clearly ritualistic. I called for Kojo to bring beer, and then he left us.
Auntie, we are his family. I am the great-grandfather of Kojo, and we thank you. We have come by lorry from Akwapim, and we have brought thanks.
By their bearing, clothes, and jewelry, it was evident Kojo's family was high-born and well-to-do, and that they treasured their boy.
We sent Kojo to town, and as proof of his goodness, he found you. We have spoken to his teachers and to your steward, Otu, who is our cousin. Without payment and without knowing his family, you, Auntie, are teaching our Kojo. Bring thanks!
They brought in a crate of vegetables, then another, and another, until the floor was covered.
Here is garden egg, here onion, plantain, pineapples, cassava, yam, cocoyam, mango, pawpaw. We want you to know that Kojo did not come from the ground like grass. He has risen like the banyan tree, and we, his roots, thank you. Every month, we will send you thanks according to the season.
Ah. Yes.
Each person shook my hand again and filed out of the house. I waited behind the screen until they had bade Kojo their final goodbyes and left him looking like a forlorn puppy.
Kojo, why didn't you tell me?
What auntie?
How could I reproach him for not telling me that his family was wealthy and he was so loved? So I lied.
That your family was coming.
I knew they would come someday. I just didn't know when.
I had been taken further on my search for Africa. Despite political bondage and economic exploitation, they had retained an ineradicable sense of self, which I envied. Could I, or any black person from the diaspora, really return to Africa?
Auntie, after I take these things to the kitchen, may I make you some white tea with lots of sugar?
Yes, Kojo. I would love some tea with milk, but no sugar.
Evening, Julian.
Hey. What are you all doing here? Don't you know I have work to do?
Julian Mayfield was an activist, academic, writer, and the leader of our group of revolutionists returnees, if such a group of eccentric expats could be led. We had gotten wind of the arrival of a package of sausage from Washington, D.C., and had converged on the Mayfield home.
Oregano and sage.
And fried pork.
All right, all right. Go out on the porch. I'll bring it along directly.
Thank you, Julian.
Homesickness was never mentioned in our crowd. We chewed the well-spiced patties and were ravenously devouring Houston and Macon, Little Rock and St. Louis.
Now, some bad news, I'm afraid. Dr. Du Bois is sick. Lucid, but very sick. He says he's stopped learning, and it's time for him to go.
Dr. Du Bois was a revered intellectual and activist. He was a leader in the Pan-African movement and sought solidarity between all people of African descent. He had come from the U.S. with his wife to live his final years in Ghana at the invitation of President Kwame Nkrumah himself.
Well, and some better news. There is to be a march on Washington, D.C., to be led by Dr. Martin Luther King.
Uh-huh. King's been in jail so much, he got a liking for those iron bars and jailhouse food.
We were brave revolutionaries, not pussyfooting nonviolent cowards. Of course, none of us, save Julian, had even been close to bloody violence, and not one of us had spent an hour in jail for our political beliefs. I kept quiet when Reverend King's name was mentioned, and managed to persuade myself I was not betraying him. Yet as maddened white citizens and political leaders vowed to die before they would see segregation come to an end, I became more resolute in rejecting nonviolence and more adamant in denying Martin Luther King.
Radicals, though we are.
Yes!
Shouldn't we, as black Americans, support our people in the States?
How?
Well, we can march here. In sympathy with the Washington march.
We need to get the word out.
Yes.
We made arrangements late into the night, our heads filled with a new and exciting charge, and our fingers still smelling of spicy pork sausage. Because of the 7-hour time difference, we plan to begin our march at midnight on the 26th in the park across from the American Embassy.
You're late, Julian.
I'm sorry. I need to talk to you. Something has happened.
Well, what's wrong?
I don't think we should tell everyone, but you should know. Dr. Du Bois is dead.
No. Oh, Julian.
Where Talman? I think we should tell everybody. They'll feel more like marching.
Maya?
I agree.
We fanned out, carrying the important news to the congregation. One person started the singing, and we all joined in.
And if I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my God and be free.
Let's march!
We marched and sang, thinking of home and the thousands who are marching in Washington, D.C., and the dapper little man, Dr. Du Bois, who said in 1904, the problem of the 20th century will be the problem of the color line. A West African downpour had drenched us in the early hours, and dawn drifted in on a ragged file of damp and worn-out marches.
Maya, I think we need to be careful. There, on the roof of the embassy.
Marines.
And they're pointing their guns this way.
Two soldiers came out of the embassy door, carrying a folded American flag. Ignoring us, they stepped smartly to the flagpole. As the flag ascended...
This is an Iwo Jima, guys!
You haven't taken Bunker Hill, you know. This is Africa!
One of the soldiers was black.
Brother! Brother, why don't you come over here and join us? What has that flag done for you?
That flag won't cover you in Alabama!
Watching the flag wave in the breeze made us nearly choke with emotion. It lifted us up with promise and broke our hearts with its denial. We knew that the two soldiers were not our enemies, and that our sneers did not hide our longing for full citizenship under that now undulating flag. The march was over. I went home alone, emptied of passion, and too exhausted to cry.
I am still a Muslim. I am still a minister. And I am still black.
Malcolm X had arrived at midday in Accra. And by evening, the Mayfields' house was filled with expatriates.
But my trip to Mecca has changed many other things about me. When I return to America, I will make statements which will shock everybody. Of course, people would be really shocked if Malcolm X wasn't shocking. Brothers and sisters... The situation in America has not lightened up. Black people are still marching, sitting in, praying in, and even swimming in. And white Americans are still saying they don't want blacks in their restaurants, churches, swimming pools, and voting booths. But here's some new news.
When I had met Malcolm 2 years earlier, he had been the bombastic spokesman for Elijah Muhammad's Nation of Islam. He called whites blue-eyed devils, and accused America of totalitarian genocide.
On this journey to Mecca, I met white men with blue eyes, who I can call brother with conviction.
We sat enthralled.
I am not in favor among the followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. But a person must make the effort to learn, and growing is the inevitable reward of learning.
So why have you come to Ghana?
The same reason I went to Cairo and Lagos. I need as many government contacts as possible, so that when I take the case of the black American before the General Assembly of the United Nations, I can be sure of African support. If South Africans can petition the UN about apartheid, then America should be shown on the world stage as a repressionist and bestial racist nation.
Yes.
Do you want us to arrange for you to meet Ghanaian officials and to see President Nkrumah?
Black Americans, you all are really something. You just got here and already you know the president.
Only Julian had actually met the president. Most of us had never even seen him in the flesh. But right now, that did not matter. In 1 week, we were able to introduce Malcolm to cabinet ministers, the African and European diplomatic corps, as well as the Cuban and Chinese ambassadors. Julian and I were his chauffeurs, while Vicky was secretary. The Ghana Press Club threw a party for him. Malcolm sat quietly, never moving. When the High Life Band took its break, Malcolm was asked to speak.
I thank you for your invitation, but I'm in no mood to dance. I think of my brothers and sisters at home, squirming under the heel of racial oppression, and I do not care to dance. I think of our brothers and sisters in the Congo, squirming under the heel of imperialist invasion, and I do not care to dance.
He visited the university and answered students' questions.
Why
have you call yourself a black man when you look more like a white man than a Negro?
I've been waiting for that question since I landed in Africa. Many people have thought it, but you're the first person to have the courage to ask. As slaves, we were the property of slave masters. Our men were worked to death. Our women were raped. Many of the children were born looking like me.
But despite all our efforts, we were not able to get Malcolm an audience with President Kwame Nkrumah.
What about Dr. Du Bois's widow? Surely she can arrange a meeting in seconds. She's so close to Nkrumah. I mean, doesn't he call her his little mother?
I've tried her. She's not available.
What? Yes, deliberately not available.
Shirley Graham Du Bois's creative intelligence. She was a composer, a playwright, a prize-winning biographer, and an activist in civil rights. None of that mattered to me. I was incensed that this powerful woman, who had a direct link to the president, was unwilling to help. On Malcolm's last night in Ghana, we were at the Chinese residency.
Maya, look, Shirley Du Bois is here.
She walked immediately to Malcolm and led him away by the arm. After nearly an hour of one-on-one conversation, Shirley and Malcolm emerged and rejoined the party.
This man is brilliant. I am taking him for my son.
Later that evening at home.
Hell, before she wouldn't even see him.
Does it matter, Maya?
Yes, it does. I can't stand that.
Hello? Yes?
Yes!
Oh, okay, bye.
Success, success!
President Nkrumah will see Malcolm at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, so Shirley must have gone straight home and called the president and told him he had to see Malcolm. She could have done that a week ago, but no.
Oh, come on, Maya. Better late than never. We should be celebrating.
The next morning, my heart was still hardened to Shirley Du Bois. When the revolutionist returnees met Malcolm after his meeting with the president, instead of inquiring about the meeting, I stood apart, pouting, as the Chinese, Yugoslav, Cuban, Algerian, and Egyptian ambassadors arrived, all vying to escort Malcolm to the airport.
Man, we ought to pay you for this visit. You've given this poor group of black exiles some status.
Which diplomatic limousine you gonna ride in, Malcolm?
I'm gonna ride with Maya and Julian to the airport.
3 6-footers tried to be comfortable in my little Fiat.
Now, Sister Maya, what do you think of Shirley Du Bois?
I let loose.
She lacks faith. She doesn't identify with the black American struggle sitting up there in the catbird seat looking down on the rest of us. She's superior.
Now, sister, I thought you were smart. But I see you were very childish.
What?
Have you thought that her husband has only been dead a few months? At her age, she needs some time to consider that she is walking around wounded, limping on one leg.
But Malcolm...
Keep your eyes on the road, Maya.
Sister, listen and listen carefully. There was a time when you didn't know what you know today. Don't be in such a hurry to condemn a person because they don't do what you do.
I felt small enough to walk around in the palm of his hand.
I will think about it.
I can't ask for any more. We are called to defend ourselves all the time in every arena. We need now more than ever hard, serious thinkers. Keep thinking, Maya, and use your thoughts wisely.
I would never forget his words. Malcolm X had the maturity of compromise. At the airport, the ambassadors swooped him away. And then he was gone, on his way back to the U.S. Malcolm's presence had elevated us. But with his departure, we were what we had been before. A little group of black folks looking for home. Out of the blue, a cable arrived from New York City
Berlin Volksoper, once original company of the Blacks, 4-day stop, ticket paid plus salary. Can you come?
It was signed Sidney Bernstein. 3 years earlier, I had been part of a successful production of Genet's scathing play in New York.
Can I come? Try stopping me.
This trip to Berlin was to lead to one of the most unusual and chilling meetings I was to ever encounter.
Clouds of heroes, young and old, have died for me.
The opening night was a great success, and afterwards we attended a reception in the theater's modern, gleaming lobby. The strain of the opening night and my efforts to hold my own with the cast exhausted me, and I was tired to the point of perversity.
Madame Angelou, you are a great artist. I am Dieter, and this is my wife.
How do you do?
Our country is uplifted by your visit. We would like you and your friends to come to supper with us at an apprecierter club. There is a jazz orchestra.
Oh, I'm too tired tonight. But I'd love to come for breakfast at yours tomorrow. I've never been in a German home.
Of course. We will prepare breakfast. I will pick you up at 10 a.m. Please feel free to invite anyone you like. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
A lot of the cast had left. And besides, I didn't think they'd be interested to see Germans en famille.
Hello.
Hello.
Did you see the show tonight?
A young and very handsome Jewish man was standing alone by the bar. He laughed easily and was a pleasure to talk with. He was an Israeli actor on tour. I told him of my invitation.
You're not inviting me, I hope. I do not mean to be rude, but why do you think they invited you?
Well, they really asked me to a nightclub. They planned to make a grand entrance. When black people are scarce, we're in style.
Do you want me to come? Did you tell them you would ask me?
Well, I hadn't seen you then.
Then I will come along. It should be interesting.
The next morning...
Madame Angelou, have you friends coming too?
Well, not a friend, exactly, but I met an Israeli actor last night, and since we were both alone, I invited him to escort me to breakfast.
There was a slight focusing of his eyes on me, followed by a gracious smile.
Ah, you mean Torvash. Wonderful. I saw him here last night. He is a very popular comedian. He tours Europe, always sold out.
Torvash sat in the front of the car with Dieter, both men talking all the while. When we arrived at a modern, spacious house, we were given seats at a table, while Dieter and his wife were in the kitchen.
Are you okay?
Yes, though. I think he was probably a Nazi.
Well, do you want to leave?
No, it's all right.
They brought beer and sausages, salmon, eggs, and pickles. Between bites,
I imagine it must be very warm,
we engaged in nerve-dulling small talk.
Yes, the weather is mostly...
Until I could bear it no longer.
Do you know, I collect jokes. I believe if you know what makes a person laugh, you can claim to understand him. I'll tell you a black American story, and you tell me a German one.
Immediately, I began to tell the tale of Br'er Rabbit, the weak animal with the sharpest brain, outwitting its well-armed adversary. I left them in no doubt that the vulnerable trickster represented my people.
Br'er Rabbit ran away with the carrots. Well, now it's your turn. Just so I can say I have really met Germans and heard their humor.
Get Torvash to tell an Israeli joke. His people are known for their black humor. No pun intended.
I do know one, but it's a German story. German and Jewish. Is that all right?
Oh, yes, please, tell it.
There was a Jewish man during World War II who had a sixth sense. He knew when the SS were going to make a raid. He would leave moments before the soldiers arrived. He'd gone on like this for 3 years. Then, one day, his talent deserted him. He was caught. The SS officer interrogating him said, "I know you are the one who has been escaping all these years. You think you are clever.
I shall see how clever you are. I shall ask you one question. If you answer correctly, I will let you go. If not, well, you know. One of my eyes is false. It was made for me by the world's greatest eye maker. If you can look in my eyes and tell me which one is false, you will be allowed to leave Germany.
The Jew said,
I know, sir, I know. Because the false one looks so human.
My father, who survived, said that was a popular story in his concentration camp.
We have a story, a folktale. Ready? Once a German worker was on his way to the factory. It was bitterly cold. He saw a small bird on the ground, too cold to move. He picked up the little bird, blew warm air on it, and because of the schnapps he had had, the bird began to stir and opened its eyes. Just then, the factory bell rang. What could he do? He looked around, and he saw a cow had left a large steaming pat on the ground. He pushed the little bird down in the hot pat and went to work. The bird recovered. He stuck his head out of the pat and very loudly began to tweet. A wolf in the forest had not eaten for days. He heard, tweet, tweet, tweet. He walked to the pat of cow dung and gobbled the bird down. There are three morals to this tale. One, remember, he who put you in the shit is not necessarily your enemy. Two, he who takes you out of the shit is not necessarily your friend. And three, the most important moral of all. Once you find yourself in the shit, keep your big mouth shut!
I'd like to go back to the hotel now.
Oh, but I must show you my collection of African art.
Oh, well, I'm afraid I'm not feeling very well.
I understand. I expect your constitution is not used to such a heavy German breakfast. But I can show you on our way out if we leave at the back. Come, please come this way. This mask is Bambara. That one is Fon. And this piece is Ashanti. I have a large collection of Ashanti gold weights. If you'd like to see in the other room.
Not this time, thank you.
Since you live in Ghana, I thought you might like to do some trade for me. Of course, I have an agent here in Berlin, but the prices are very high. And I'm certain Africans don't see 1% of that money.
No, I don't trade. And I particularly don't trade in African art.
Good for you, Maya.
I am a serious collector. I pay you well, very well.
She doesn't trade, Dieter.
And I'd really like to get back to my hotel.
Dieter was perfectly polite as he drove us back.
Oh, I'm sorry. I started something I didn't expect.
At least we know now why you were invited. We can't afford to be so innocent, here or anywhere. Unless we want the return of slavery and concentration camps.
When I returned to Ghana, Malcolm X had written several times. The U.S. was on the brink of making great changes, and the time was ripe for the organization of Afro-American unity. They had good people working for them, but what they needed was an experienced coordinator, like me. Could I be more use in the U.S.? Was it time for me to go back? When Chief Nanang Kechia, an eminent scholar and tribal chief whom I'd met through the university, offered me a trip to eastern Ghana, I accepted gratefully. It would be my last trip before leaving. After driving several hours in beautiful countryside, something, a presence, seemed to inhabit the car.
What is it?
Eh?
We were approaching a bridge, and suddenly I was terrified.
No. No! Stop! Stop the car!
What is it, Maya?
Get out. We've got to get out. We've got to walk across the bridge.
I had rarely felt such terror. I simply dare not travel across by car.
Why are you so afraid? Do you know anything about this bridge?
No.
Have you heard of the Keta Bridge?
No.
The old bridge was infamous for crumbling away during any flooding. A century ago, in times of crisis, passengers would stop and walk as only people on foot could hope to get to the other side. Come on.
We came to some narrow steps leading down to the market.
No, no, bada.
An older woman above me, unusually tall, was blotting out the light.
I'm sorry, Auntie, but I don't speak Ewe.
She's American.
I produced my driver's license.
See? I'm American.
Nana showed her the license. She moved towards the light, and when she raised her head, I saw her fully for the first time.
Oh, Lord.
I nearly fell back down the steps. She had the wide face and slanted eyes of my grandmother. The cheekbones and the lips of my grandmother. Outrage had given way to melancholy.
Why does she put her hands on her head like that?
That's the way they mourn.
Another woman joined her, and they were both crying.
I'm sorry. Nana, do I look like someone who died?
At first, the woman thought you were a daughter of a friend who had not visited for a long time, and she was angry. But now, you remind them of someone. During the slave period, Keta was hit very hard by the slave trade. The only escapees were children who ran away and hid in the bush. They saw terrible things. All that they remembered, they told over and over. These women are the descendants of those orphan children. And you, sister, you look so like them. Even the tone of your voice is like theirs. That is why they mourn. Not for you, but for their lost people.
They see their history in my face. They hear their ancestors speaking through my voice.
There was much to cry for, much to mourn. But in my heart, I felt exalted. Despite everything, we had survived. I was not sad departing Ghana. Many years earlier, I, or rather someone like me, had been taken by force. This second leave-taking would not be so onerous, for now I knew my people had never completely left Africa. We had sung it in our blues, shouted it in our gospel. We had changed its color, modified its rhythms, yet it was Africa which infused our limbs and cracked in our laughter. I could nearly hear the old ones chuckling.
That was All God's Children Need Traveling Shoes, the fifth volume of Maya Angelou's extraordinary memoirs. The narrator, Older Maya, was Ajoa Ando, and Maya was Pippa Bennett-Warner. All God's Children Need Travelling Shoes was dramatized by Patricia Kumper and produced and directed by Pauline Harris. We present A Song Flung Up to Heaven, the sixth volume of Maya Angelou's extraordinary memoirs.
Noah built the ark out of gopher wood. The flood it came and the ark it stood. The old ark, a mover in. The old ark was a Pan Am jet. And I'm going home. It was 1965, and I was returning from Accra, Ghana, to the United States. I was wearing traditional West African dress, and I sensed myself out of place. I was among more white people than I had seen in the previous 4 years in Ghana. I was looked at with distaste, if not downright disgust. Holding Malcolm's letter, I contemplated the circumstances to which I was returning.
Dear Maya, I'm enclosing some articles that will give you an idea of my daily experiences here and why it sometimes takes me a long time to write.
The climate in the U.S. was turbulent, and black people had gone from sit-ins to set fires and march-ins to break-ins. Malcolm X had announced his desire to create the Organization of African American Unity, the OAAU, to take the plight of African Americans to the United Nations and World Council.
Your analysis of our people's tendency to talk over the head of the masses in a language that is too far above and beyond them is certainly true. You can communicate because you have plenty of soul, and you always keep your feet firmly rooted on the ground.
The passion my people would exhibit under Malcolm's leadership was going to rid the United States of racism once and for all. Nelson Mandela and Robert Sobukwe were in prison. But once we had rid our country of hate, we would give South Africans something visionary and new to inspire their struggle. By the time we arrived in New York, I had discarded my vilification of the white racists on the plane and had even begun to feel a little sorry for them. But the sound at the airport was startling. I knew I was not ready for New York's strenuous energy.
Hello?
Malcolm, it's Maya.
Maya! You finally got here. How was your trip?
It was fine.
You stay at the airport. I'll be there to pick you up. I'll leave right now.
I'm going straight to San Francisco. My plane leaves soon.
I thought you were coming to work with us in New York.
I'll be back in a month. I promise. I have to get used to being back in the United States, so I'm going to spend some time with my mother.
Okay, Maya. I had to leave my car in the Holland Tunnel. Somebody was trying to get me. I jumped into a white man's car. He panicked. I told him who I was, and you know what he said?
Malcolm.
He said, "Get down low. I'll get you out of this." You believe that, Maya?
Yes. Well, I'll call you next week when I get my bearings.
Yeah, do that. Safe trip.
At San Francisco Airport.
Come along, Maya.
I'm coming.
My mother was smaller and prettier than I remembered. The porters danced attendance on her, and she didn't even seem to notice.
You'll never guess who's waiting in the car to see you.
My brother.
Oh, Bailey.
Maya, get over here and give me a hug.
He had flown in from Hawaii to meet me.
You're a good-looking woman, baby. Your sister grew prettier, Bailey.
Yeah, but good looks run in this family. She didn't have anything to do with that. Now, Maya, tell me about my nephew, Guy.
I read in the papers that you were coming back to work for Malcolm X in some new organization. I hope not. I really hope not.
But, Mother...
Maya.
Bailey's face was solemn as he shook his head.
If you feel you have to do that, work for no money, go back to Martin Luther King. He's really trying to help our people. Malcolm X is a rabble rouser.
You have no idea.
Ma, let it go.
Bailey, though less than 2 years older than I, had been my counselor and protector for as long as I could remember. I held my peace. Later, he explained,
"Don't set yourself up to be knocked down. Keep your expectations in control. You know, some folks say they want change. They just want exchange. They want to have what the haves have got so they don't have it anymore."
Is that why Mother doesn't like Malcolm?
No. Mom just wants to be left alone, Ma. She thinks if no one gets in her way, she can get her freedom by herself. She doesn't even want Martin Luther King to tell her where her liberation lies. Certainly not Malcolm X.
You remember this, baby?
Mother's Victorian house on Fulton Street was exactly as I remembered it.
The recipe for jollof rice you sent me.
Cook about a pound of rice, saute a couple of three onions, and not too much cooking oil for a while? Then put three or four or five right-sized tomatoes? What is this, Maya?
Not all of us are chefs in swank Hawaiian hotels like you, Bailey.
I knew what she meant. I followed that recipe exactly, and the dish was a smashing success. Well, sit and eat the pair of you.
I just wish Guy was here.
My son had attended university in Ghana, and when I considered returning to the U.S., he had encouraged me to come back. But he wanted his freedom, and had stayed there.
He is a boy.
Who thinks he is a man.
That's the nature of the group. When they're boys, they want to be treated like men. And when they're gray-haired old coots, they go around acting like boys.
You have raised him with love. The fruit won't fall far from the tree.
Every time I tried to talk to him about his future, he would cut me off.
Stop worrying, Maya. Your son is just a man who is trying to live his own life.
He's right, Maya. You've got plenty of people out there looking out for him. And when he's ready to come back, he will. Listen, I told folks you both would be here, and they'll start dropping by any minute now.
With the shadow of Guy's absence, there were bleak moments in my homecoming that no one could erase. Yet the evening was a riot of laughter, with stories and memories awakened and relished in the bright San Francisco sunlight. 2 days later, the golden morning was definitely a San Francisco Sunday. The streets were empty. San Franciscans who hadn't gone to church were sleeping off Saturday night parties. I had been home 48 hours, and already I had a creeping sensation that I should be moving on. I dressed quickly and left the house, walking up hills and through parks, until I found myself at...
Maya, I'm so sure you'd call by. Oh.
Aunt Lottie Wells had come to San Francisco from Los Angeles 10 years earlier and had joined the family.
Come in. Oh, I was so sure you'd call by. I didn't go to church. But have you seen the news this morning?
No, I've just been walking.
I was so pleased that you'd come back, and then I saw the news, and I thought, why have you come back?
What?
Why did you come back to this crazy place?
Well, I came back because
are crazy here. I mean, really crazy. Otherwise, why? Why would they have just killed that man in New York?
No. No.
Where are you going, Maya?
No!
Maya!
I walked into a bedroom and locked the door.
Maya! Talk to me, Maya!
I didn't have to ask. I knew that man in New York was Malcolm X, and someone had just killed him.
Ma! Open this door! Open it now!
At times, when my life had been ripped apart, a touch of narcolepsy befriended me. When I discovered my lover was unfaithful, or my son was involved in a terrible accident, when I couldn't eat or speak, the one thing I could manage was sleep. This time, I woke up knowing everything. I was in Aunt Lottie's house, and Malcolm was dead.
Ma, let me in!
I had returned from Africa to give my energies and wit to Malcolm's cause, and he was dead.
Wake up and open this damn door, Ma, or I'll break it down.
He would.
Oh, Bailey.
I'm sorry, baby. Go to the bathroom and wash your face. I'm taking you somewhere. Somewhere important. Go on.
Bailey waited in the hall, holding my purse and jacket.
Put this on. Say goodbye to Aunt Lottie.
Oh, I'm so sorry, baby. I'm so sorry.
My equilibrium failed me. So, Bailey.